At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to Money Talk with Skylar Fleming, where talking about money is encouraged. Let's get talking. Welcome, Money Buddies, to this week's episode of Money Talk. I'm your host, Skylar Fleming, and today we're talking about retirement planning. But wait, before you turn this episode off and think that retirement is so far away and not something that you need to worry about, let me make sure to mention that we're going to be talking a lot about the power of time in this episode and how being young and starting early or starting wherever you are can be super helpful. The earlier you do the math to calculate your retirement need, the easier and easier it's going to be to hit that target. Plus, we're going to spend some time today talking about the tools that you can use to save for retirement and the biggest tool inside every investor's toolbox. So you're going to want to make sure to stay tuned for that so you can learn what tool you need to get out of your toolbox and start using today. Today's episode is going to be a great one that you won't want to miss. And this is going to help everybody from my youngest to my oldest listeners because just like working, it's something you all have to do, so is saving for retirement and stopping working. I'm also going to give you some great tips to help you stick to your goals and stay on track. But today's Money Buddy helping me dive into this topic is Eric Brotman. Eric Brotman is a CFP and the CEO of BFG Financial Advisors with over 25 years of experience as a trusted advisor. He believes financial literacy is key to well-being and is the author of multiple books on personal finance and the host of Don't Retire, Graduate, a podcast which I am going on very soon. So be sure to head over there and check out his podcast as well if you want to give me a listen over there. Eric's approachable and actionable financial advice has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes.com, Yahoo Finance, the Baltimore Sun, and others. And I'm excited to have Eric on. This is a great conversation. I know you're going to enjoy it. I really had fun with this one. And the money talking points are also going to be great after the interview. So make sure to stick around for those. The money talking points for this week are: what would work optional mean to you? 2, how can you take the next step up in your savings? And 3, how can automation help you get started? With those money talking points in mind, let's get talking. Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's interview. Joining me today, I have Eric Brotman, and we're talking about saving for retirement. This is going to be a great conversation. I'm really excited for this one to help people think through some of the things you need for retirement and some of the ideas that come with it. Eric, could you introduce yourself for everyone real fast?
My name is Eric Brotman. I run BFG Financial Advisors as the CEO here in suburban Maryland. I've been in the financial advisory business over 30 years, which makes me the old guy in the conversation. I also have a consulting practice, a media firm. I write books on financial independence and host a podcast called Don't Retire, Graduate. Ultimately, I'm just trying to help people learn that financial literacy is the first step toward financial freedom.
Awesome. And there's so much that comes from simple conversations that we can teach financial literacy. I love that. We're going to talk maybe a little bit beyond some of the basics today with saving for retirement and such. The principles we're going to talk about today can still help you get that financial foundation in place that you need. So awesome, Eric. To start it off, when people hear the word retirement, what should they be thinking about when they try to figure out how much they need?
They should think about what retirement is, because retirement is changing. Retirement historically meant the absence of work. It meant daytime TV and shuffleboard, and that's no longer the way life works. And so I think before we figure out how much money we need for retirement, we have to figure out what we're going to do in retirement, what we're going to be in retirement, and what retirement means to us. I think the qualitative things matter just as much as the quantitative. So to me, retirement is the absence of needing to work, not the absence of work itself. So reaching financial independence, whether you're 47 or 77, is your ticket to being retired. Then you can only work on passion projects. You can do the things you love, whether it's for money or not. So let's start with that. In terms of reaching financial independence, such that work is optional, what you need to do is build a nest egg or an income stream or a combination of a nest egg and income streams that will replicate as close to 100% of your pre-retirement income, gross to gross, net of savings as possible. So I'll put that in plain English. If you're making $100,000 a year today and you're saving $20,000 a year, 20%, so you're living on 80. I'm not talking net income, we're talking gross, because we don't know what tax rules are going to be down the road. Mm-hmm. Gross to gross. If you're making $100,000 a year, you're saving 20, then you're living on 80 functionally. Taking that $80,000, adjusting it for inflation for the number of years you plan to work, and then figuring out what is the nest egg required to replicate that income using a reasonable withdrawal rate. We're going to talk about different ways to create income in retirement, different ways to structure the use of your assets once you get mm-hmm. there. 4% was always sort of a rule of thumb, and I think it's a slippery slope because 4% means a lot of different things to different people at different times of their lives and at different mm-hmm. times in the economy and markets. And if we use that as the line and we said, well, of that $80,000, you plan to work another 20 years, adjusted for inflation, let's say that $80,000 is $140,000, and I'm making this up, but it's $140,000, mm-hmm. which today sounds like a lot of money, but then is the same thing as 80 is today.
Yeah.
And let's say out of that 140, the 40 is going to come from pension or Social Security or some kind of income stream that you have. So you need to make up the difference, and that's the 100. Mm-hmm. If you get to $100,000 with a 4% withdrawal, means you need $2.5 million. $2.5 million will throw off $100,000 a year at 4%, assuming that is a safe withdrawal rate. And mm-hmm. safe is the wrong word, because sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. But that's how you figure out how much you need. Is what are the income streams? What is your lifestyle? And I think if you plan for 100% and you get to 93, you've got a pretty good thing going. You plan mm-hmm. on sort of those rules of thumb where they say you only need 70% of your pre-retirement income. I think you're planning to fail. Mm. And I think then if you don't hit that goal, you're really in trouble. So target 100%. Try to not change your life just because there's no paycheck. And if you try to build that nest egg and you're short, you can still do some of the things that make you money later in life. You know, I've had folks on my show who are in their 80s who are starting businesses. Like, this is not our grandparents' mm-hmm. retirement. You know, this isn't the gold watch and then sitting on the couch waiting to die.
Yeah, and I love how you took a little bit more of an aggressive approach to calculating your savings versus that 70% or 80% of your income is a target. But I like what you said. Go for the 100. Make your life the exact same it could be. And then you're going to be a whole lot more comfortable making adjustments. People can tend to spend less once they get into retirement. There's a few less things that maybe you're obligated to do. But if you're not forced to do that, you're living so much more of a comfortable life. So I like the math that you started there of saying, go for 100%, figure out how much you need. And then you can adjust backwards if you don't quite hit it. But getting, like you said, 90% of 100 instead of 60% of 70 is a whole lot of a better number. There's a big gap between those.
Huge. It makes a giant difference. And, you know, targeting to keep your lifestyle the way it is changes the game in retirement, too, because historically, mm-hmm. if you were shooting for 70%, you were going to have less income in retirement. That's where the premise of the 401k and the IRA came in, where, hey, let's take a deduction while we're in a high tax bracket and mm-hmm. let's then pull the money out when we're in a lower tax bracket. That is planning to fail. And so, you know, I want our clients to have the highest tax bracket possible later in life because it means they're making a lot of money. I don't want them to pay a lot of taxes. We can do some tax planning around that. But I want them to make enough money that they are at least in the crosshairs of tax issues. It's much mm-hmm. better to have a tax problem than an income problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when people say they try to avoid taxes outright or make sure they don't have enough income to pay the next bracket or whatever, it's like, taxes is a sign you're making money. So it's okay if you need to pay them. Like you said, there's planning that can be done around them to minimize them. But having to pay taxes is a cruel reality, I guess. But it's not this thing you need to all out avoid.
No. And I think that there are lots of different advice sources out there, some of which say, oh, when you do an estate plan, it should be a zero tax plan. Well, maybe it should and maybe it shouldn't. Maybe there's other factors in your world. Mm-hmm. The tax tail should never wag the financial dog. Mm-hmm. If you have a tax problem, there are things you can do to mitigate it. Right now, it's about, are you starting good habits? Are you putting away enough money? Are you on track to reach financial independence at a reasonable age? And then you modify that over time because it's not a linear equation.
Mm-hmm. There's so much adjustment that gets to go on. One thing I've learned is that assumptions are always wrong. So you're going to start your plan, you're going to figure out the calculations, and then something's going to change.
Correct. I love that. And we do tell people the math is accurate, but this isn't what's going to happen. Unless you're planning on 7% return on some investment, mm-hmm. and I'm using that as a pure hypothetical, it's going to be very different if it's 7, 7, 7, 7, 7 than if it's plus 21 minus 14 plus mm-hmm. 3. That's not the same as if it's steady. when you start looking at sequence and series of returns, it's not as simple as saying, what's the average?
Yeah, because there could be, like you said, that 20% year where now you have all this opportunity to do some tax planning, or you go down and now you have that opportunity. So that's awesome. We're off to the races here with some great things for people to think about. There's a whole lot of opportunity, and I love that. But I'm excited to hear your answer to this next question, because you took the approach of saying, save for 100% of your income. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to hear how you answer this one. When people try to calculate this number, should they be trying to calculate for early retirement and realize it may come a little bit later? Or should they calculate for that normal 65 or whatever retirement and try to speed it up? Which approach do you think is better mentally?
That gives me my favorite answer ever, which is it depends. Some of it depends on your lifestyle. Do you have three children or none? Do you have a very modest lifestyle, or are you keeping up with the Joneses? What do you do for a living? Are you sitting behind a desk, or are you building bridges? You have to consider the possibility that you can't physically, mentally, or emotionally continue to work in the way you're working now. None of us like to picture ourselves as older or frail or any of those things, and yet age is cruel. And if you're working in a very manual, physical way, then I think it's real important to plan for the possibility that you may need to stop doing what you do sooner than you had hoped. And I'm not talking about being disabled. I'm just talking about being fatigued, being tired. Mm-hmm. Like an old car, you can keep changing the oil, but at some point it makes that noise like knees do. I think a lot of it depends on what you do for a living. And also, do you love it? If you work at something you love, it won't feel like toil. If you hate it and can't wait to be done, you're going to plan for the soonest possible date that you can give your 2 weeks' notice.
Yeah.
If you're wanting a job you can't stand, try and train yourself or learn some things or try and find another job, because that's miserable and no one should live that way. But if you are living that way and that's what you do, then you're one of those people who wants to be done early. If what you do is a labor of love, you want to do it until you're not useful. If you're 82 and you're still functional and useful and having fun, go for it. Be financially independent before that, but
yeah,
but
no, why not? Don't be buried in debt and trying to saving.
People say, I don't want to die at my desk. And I think it depends what your desk is. If you're a professional skier and you're 87 and your last run is the one that kills you, that's a pretty good way to go out, right? It's different if you're an architect and you're working yourself to death and you die at your drawing table. That's miserable. So I think it depends what you do for a living. It depends on people.
Yeah, I love that. And I do think, at least for my wife and I, when I thought through this question, we calculated that earlier financial independence number, but then we did realize my wife enjoys her job. She just got started in her career as a physician assistant. So she has a long time ahead of her to earn and make money. So we were able to back down off of that intimidating savings number to get to financial independence quickly. But we were saying, hey, as much as we keep increasing this number, we know we keep bringing that financial independence date closer. So I think calculating both can be super useful. And I like what you said about actually think through your life, because if you're just doing the math, then you're missing out on so much of personal finance.
Correct. And I know too many people who have wanted to get done early and they squirrel away every penny and they never take the trip and they never live their lives. I think there's something to living for today as well. I'm not saying you live for today and you save nothing and you hope for the best. I'm saying there's a balance. There's a balance. People who wait to take the trip and then lose a spouse where they're not healthy enough to do the bike trip through Thailand or whatever it is that they wanted to do, take the trip. If you're putting away enough money and you don't have adverse debt and you're building good habits, enjoy your life. I mean, I don't think it's about the scoreboard. They say he who dies with the most toys wins, and I don't buy it. He who dies with the most toys still dies and probably didn't play with most of them.
Yeah, and the person with the most money still dies, and the person with the least money still dies. That's where you got to strike that balance.
Life is short, and this isn't a dress rehearsal. Skylar, this is it. This is what we got.
Yeah, so calculate your numbers and work the math in the back of your mind. Ultimately, strike that balance. My podcast, I'm sure, is sick of hearing that my wife and I went to Hawaii, but this is such a perfect example. Right after my wife graduated PA school, we still had student loans needing to be paid off, but we had planned for this trip about 3 or 4 years in advance and had been saving for it. It was a no-brainer. I look back on it probably once a week and think about how great it was. That money could have gone towards shrinking that financial independence date, but we don't regret spending it on a trip like that. Balance can be extremely liberating once you are able to find it.
Yes, I think wealthy and miserable is not a great combination. Enjoy your life.
Yeah, really, that's fantastic. We've had so many great conversations so far. I want to talk about how people can, once they figure out this math, how they actually stick to it. And I think that's through a written plan. I think it's super helpful for people. How do you think a written plan helps with the behavioral side of this planning?
Well, a written plan is an excellent start. And I think there's a certain accountability to not only writing it down, but to sharing it with someone, whether it's your spouse, whether it's your close friend, whether it's a professional advisor, whomever it is, being accountable matters. Financial planning, like anything else, requires an enormous amount of discipline. You know, it's no different than the discipline to grab the apple instead of the cupcake or to work out when you could be sitting on the couch eating chips. There's a discipline involved. And so that accountability matters. If you write it down, then it's no longer a dream. Now it's a goal. And that's true for anything in life. If you've written it down, you've taken the time to think about it, you're monitoring it, you're looking at it regularly. It's not enough to write it down, stick it on a shelf, and pull it out in 10 years and hope it's still right. You have to use it, too. Not enough to buy the treadmill. You have to still walk on said treadmill. Writing it down allows you to be focused. It allows you to be accountable. And I think that's the first step. But it also has to be monitored. It has to be adjusted regularly. That doesn't mean every week. It doesn't mean you have to write down every cup of coffee you bought. It does mean looking at the big picture, knowing that every year is going to be a little different. There'll be years where, depending on what you do for a living, there might be years where you make more or less money. There might be years where there's a windfall or a strange expense, a medical expense. Life happens. You have to create it, write it down. You have to memorialize it. You have to be accountable. But lastly, you have to monitor it over time because life changes in an instant so regularly. Some of those are opportunities, and some of them are blessings, and some of them are tragedies or threats. And so you just have to be ready for whatever. None of us know what tomorrow holds. So being ready for it and then monitoring it and then having somebody to monitor it with, whether it's a spouse or partner, whether it's somebody professional, whether it's just a best friend, and you sit down over coffee every couple months and say, here's my plan. How's yours? Any of those strategies will work.
Yeah, and I love the idea of checking in on it. I love to call my community that listens here the money buddies, similar to the gym buddy. And I think that is that accountability piece that you talk about. So if someone's able to find their money buddy who they can check in with regularly on their plan, that friend can say, hey, why are you still single stock picking or something? Like, they can throw ideas like that at you to help you out. Those are the sort of things that just bouncing it off somebody can help you with just brainstorming and figuring out new ideas.
Well, or if you commit to paying your student loan down by 30% this year, and then you get together and you haven't done it, someone should hold you to the fire and say, well, why didn't you do it? Is it because there was a medical emergency, or is it because you just changed your mind, or did you forget? So staying on track does matter. This is a marathon, not a sprint, for sure.
Yeah. Why is it so hard to actually start putting the savings plan in place? Like, maybe in their written plan, they put invest 10% in my 401k to get the company match, and then they can't quite do it. Why can that be so difficult for people to get started with?
I think inertia is a very powerful force. My limited physics education would say that it's the most powerful force in the universe. Getting started is hard, no matter what it is, whether it's a nutrition plan, an exercise plan, whether it's a financial plan, whether it's a career plan, an educational plan. Getting started is the hardest part. Once you leave the house, once you take that first step, it's much easier. It's much easier to start putting money into a 401k than to start necessarily at 10%. Some people will start at 4% or 6% and say, look, I'm going to get it to 10. Maybe it's set up to be automatic. More things you can put on autopilot from a saving and investing standpoint, the better off you are. Because you don't want, if you're dollar cost averaging, and dollar cost averaging is not a miracle cure. It doesn't always work. However, it will set your behavior where you're putting away X dollars or X percent every month or every check. It eliminates the psychological torture that saying, oh, is this a good time to invest? Or saw this on the news yesterday, or was thinking about this shiny thing I wanted in my driveway. If you build those behaviors, once you've got them, it's so easy to tweak them. If you're putting 8% in your 401k and your goal is to do 10, it's not hard to go from 8 to 10. It's hard to go from zero to anything.
Yeah, I love that. That's probably the quote of the episode right there. It's hard to go from zero to anything, but you can take those incremental steps. So that was great. I also want to mention that book came to my mind called The Automatic Millionaire. It talks about that slow increasing. You're not going to miss that 7 to 8%, but you're going to feel that 0 to 10% jump. But if you can slowly put in that slight increase of 1%, your lifestyle is going to adjust in a way that benefits you versus adjusting in a way that doesn't benefit you because you're increasing your spending. So I think that's one thing to watch as you're maybe making more money or getting raises is to increase that percentage that's going to retirement.
You can increase the percentage, or if you're on track, you can maintain the percentage so that it's a higher dollar figure. You don't want your lifestyle to become an albatross. If you are making three times the money you used to, it doesn't mean you need three times the lifestyle. They say that a fish will grow to the size of its environment. And if it's in a fish bowl, it'll be so big. And if it's in the ocean, it'll grow. The same thing's true with our lifestyles. If every time we get a raise, we amplify our lifestyle like we were trying to put it on MTV Cribs back in the day or something, that's not the best way to do it. If you keep the percentage the same, or if you have that percentage increasing over time, you won't feel it incrementally. It won't matter. But if you postpone this and you live a certain lifestyle and then you're like, oh boy, I'm 45 and I haven't done it yet, the pain is going to be significant to try and get that under control.
Yeah. Because then you got to go from 0 to 20% in terms of your retirement savings. There's some big numbers you got to jump there.
Well, and it's much easier to stay wealthy than to get wealthy. So if you've built good habits and you've started to build a nest egg, your nest egg, by its very nature, based on your behavior and based on reasonable assumptions, will grow. And if it's growing, it's growing while you're asleep. If it's something you have to do by rolling your sleeves up and putting more away, that's not growing while you sleep. That's growing while you toil, and that sounds terrible.
Yeah. Awesome. That's a great conversation right there. I want to move into some of these last things I have for my audience, which is primarily young adults. So I want to talk about the power that they have of time. And mainly, like, if they're starting to do this math and maybe they don't quite understand the magic of compound interest, and they say, oh, my monthly contributions of $500 a month, that's never going to add up to that $2.5 million or whatever you gave us in the beginning. Why is that? What makes that difference?
Well, the formula itself, I actually, one of the chapters in my book has the formula as part of the title, because it doesn't look simple. If you've done algebra, that's all it is. But when you look at that formula, the thing that drives this exponentially is time. That is the factor that will make the biggest difference. And so when you look at $500, it's not just $500 a check or a month or a week or whatever it is. It's that plus what it's growing, and then it's interest on your interest. It's growth on your growth. And the 500 probably shouldn't stay stagnant. If 500 represents 3% of your income and your income goes up, now the 500 is 520 and 540 and 560 and it's growing and it's got time on its side. And more time you have, the more money can amplify. It is not a linear equation. It is very much a curve. Starting early is the single greatest way to build real sustainable wealth, even if you start small. The habits are hard to start and easy to adjust. When we tell young people, and we work with a lot of young folks, our firm does not have an asset minimum. So we work with folks at all different stages of life. For young individuals, young couples, young families, it's about building those habits and getting started. And we can show what that math will do. If you're 25 years old and you've got a 40-year horizon and you start doing something monthly, it's much better than if you're already 55, even if you could put away a whole lot more per month because you're 55 and you have all this extra money, you still won't build the same nest egg as you would if you had started 30 years earlier with smaller numbers. The time is the most powerful piece of this puzzle. Everything else is window dressing by comparison. So if you're in a position to start early, whether it's your first Roth or your first employee benefit plan or your first savings account, for Pete's sake, I know that earns nothing, but at least you're in the habit of doing things. Whatever you begin early, you will continue doing. You'll get married potentially, and then you and your spouse will have different habits, and you have to sort of navigate that, which is interesting, because if one of you is a spender and one of you is a saver, there's conflict that can happen. Or if you're both savers, you might never leave the house. You might eat ramen noodles every night. So there's a balance that gets struck there too.
Yeah, and I love what you said right there about that. Time helps the younger investor more than any sort of big income, because I think that's the financial nerd's favorite trick question. Who's going to have more money, so-and-so with less income and more time, or more income and less time? And it's always time is the biggest factor.
Always, especially if you can get some tax deferral in various ways, because that big income also means you might be paying 40 or 45% in tax versus 20 or 25%. That matters too. It's not how much your account says it's worth. It's how much you can actually spend. And so if all of your money is in an IRA and you haven't paid taxes on it yet, and you now need large withdrawals, it's not the same as if it was sitting in a brokerage account.
Yeah, there's tax consequences to think about too, which transitions me perfectly to my next question about the Roth account. My young adult listeners are thinking, oh, I have so much time, I have so much potential, I don't have to put a ton of money away right now and I'll be okay. But what kind of additional benefit would a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k add for them?
First and foremost, I wish it had existed when I was in my first job, because I started in the workforce 30 plus years ago and started putting away right away. And almost all of it was traditional, which means I've grown my wealth and therefore I've also grown my future tax bill. Had I been able to grow that money in a way that it wouldn't be taxed during my lifetime, it's a godsend. There are four places where most Americans can put money where during their lifetimes and potentially beyond, it's never taxed again from an income standpoint. And the Roth is one of them. So the Roth IRA, Roth 401k is an enormous tool, particularly for young people, particularly for folks who aren't making as high an income as they like. But at any age, the Roth can be a nice thing for tax diversification. But there are four places to put them. I'm not going to put you on the spot with a quiz. I've done this before in rooms full of professionals, and sometimes folks whiff on it. But I did publish a white paper on it that's free. And so if your listeners are interested in reading more about the ways that they can grow wealth without paying future taxes, go to lowtaxbook.com and you can read about the four strategies, Roths being one of them, including the way I'm using them personally. Hopefully folks will check that out.
I would assume, is HSA one of the other ones?
It is. Oh man, you're two for, if you get the other two, then you will win some kind of prize. The HSA, hands down, is the greatest tax tool ever invented. It goes beyond the Roth because it's the only triple tax free vehicle.
The HSA is something we could talk about forever. We just spent a moment talking about how young adults or younger listeners can take this power of time, take the power of a Roth account and get going with their investing. But maybe someone's a little later, they feel like that might not be perfect for them. So they're struggling to find the motivation to get started. How can the listeners who aren't in that young adult camp find the motivation to save?
Well, I think sometimes the motivation is not wanting to live under a bridge. I mean, sometimes the motivation is negative reinforcement. I think probably the best thing to do is to start with a conversation with your spouse or significant other if you're married. It is to take inventory and be honest with where you are. It is never too late to start. It is always better to start sooner. But if you're 42, you're not too old to plan for retirement, to reach financial independence. You just may have to work a little harder to get there, because you have a little less time on your side. But beginning with inventory and then creating what I'll call it pay yourself first, you know, rather than paying all your bills with your paychecks and then hoping there's money left over at the end of the month, and sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't, instead, take that first 5, 10, 15, 20% of what you make and do good things with it, whether it's excess debt payments or savings or investing, or that's for the long term. Learn to live on 80%. If you can live on less than you make, you will always grow some form of wealth. And so the motivation is, it is better to start, if you're 42, it's better to start than now than when you're 44. Waiting a little longer, kicking that can down the road a little longer will not make it better and will make it materially harder.
Yeah, and also to think about, if you feel like you're struggling to get started or maybe you're a little older, think about who you have to pass the money on to. And that timeline too, maybe that'll help you think, okay, maybe I'm not going to get to this massive portfolio by the time I fully retire and I'll have to figure out some other options, but maybe there's an opportunity to set someone else up for the future. So maybe that motivates you too.
I know a lot of people for whom that's a priority and others who are like, that's their problem. I think it takes all kinds, this idea of, you know, I'm not working super hard to make my kids rich. There's definitely some of that out there. I remember seeing on my father's desk years ago, 40 years ago probably, I was in his office and I saw a book on it that said How to Die Broke. It was literally about spending your last dollar with your last breath. And I actually think, as he is alive and well right now, I think he's planning on that, which is fine. It's his money. Go for it. But the motivation really is not wanting to be a burden to your kids. So it's not so much about trying to make them rich. It's about not having to live with them or have them pay your bills. That's a very embarrassing way to go out. I told both of my folks years ago, you don't have to leave me a plug nickel, but please take care of yourself so I don't have to pay your bills while I'm paying my own and paying for my kids' education and doing all the things at once. Just being self-sufficient, even if you're not wealthy, if you're getting by, being self-sufficient and not having to call your son or daughter and say, I'm stuck, I need some money. That is an awful call none of us want to make.
Yeah. I love that. We've spanned the whole range today, from getting started early with a Roth account towards making sure you're not sticking your kids in that financial sandwich where they're paying for your money and their kids' money. So that's fantastic. This has been a great conversation, Eric. Thank you for coming on. This was great. Couple final questions here. We'll learn where people can connect with you. But the last question I ask everybody, and just to get your mind thinking about it, is what's one thing about retirement planning that you wish you would have known in your 20s? But before you give that answer, where can people find you online?
Our company is at bfgfa.com. That's BFG Financial Advisors. And for folks who want to check out the books and workbooks and podcasts and the free resources, brotmanmedia.com.
Awesome.
In terms of what I wish I had known at 20, I think I wish I had known that this game truly was exponential and that the habits mattered more. I did not do a good job in my 20s. I got married young. I got divorced young. I started over at 30. 30 years old, I essentially had a net worth of zero and had to get started. That's proof that you don't have to get it right the first time, but boy, I wish I had. And I'm in wonderful shape and I'm blessed in lots of ways, but the lift in your 30s is heavier than it is in your 20s. So I wish I had realized sort of what that looked like and made some decisions around it. But, you know, life happens, Skylar. Life happens, yeah. And it happens to all of us in different ways that we don't expect. And so you just do the best you can and you keep moving forward.
Yeah, there's always options. There's always an opportunity. It'll be a little bit more challenging if you start later, but it's still possible. Like, I think that's the ultimate thing. You can always still make it. Eric, thank you so much for joining. This has been a wonderful conversation. I appreciate having you on.
Oh, it's been great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much to Eric for coming on this episode. Wasn't that fantastic? I know I enjoyed the interview, and I'm sure you enjoyed listening to it. But let's start off with the first money talking point here. What would work optional mean to you? Well, this is in reference to a phenomenal book that I love to mention often and I enjoy reading called Work Optional. A couple notes that I have from the book from the last time that I read it. Age 65, it's an arbitrary milestone. It's something just randomly picked out that we decided, hey, people die shortly after that so they can stop working shortly before this age or whatever. You can retire earlier by breaking away from the standard work lifestyle whenever you want. 65 is just a random number thrown out there. It's not a legal requirement. You can stop working whenever. There are several options to this, including full-on early retirement, semi-retirement, or career intermissions like sabbaticals and things like that. There are a lot of options to adjust and change your standard work lifestyle. One of the things from the book that I really like is creating a money mission statement that reflects your priorities. Automate your savings goals and emotional triggers so that you don't have to worry about those as much. That way you can ensure your money is serving your long-term goals with that automation that you already have in place. We are going to talk about automation more here in a little bit, but that's just some notes that I took from the book called Work Optional. And I want to put this out here as well. An idea that I've been tossing around is book reports. What do you think about that? Could you potentially see yourself wanting to read book reports on my website and on my blog? What do you think about me taking my thoughts and summaries from books that I've read about personal finance and distilling them into some sort of actionable information that you can take and take action on even before reading the book? Let me know what you think about that. Shoot me an email or submit a comment on my website, Spotify, or YouTube. You know how to get a hold of me. So please reach out if you'd be interested in that. But the ultimate goal of this money talking point is to consider what would it mean to you to not have to work? And I put a ton of emphasis on the words have to because that's the whole point of it being optional. Do you work because you actually enjoy it? And you know, as a kid, I grew up a lot hearing people say, well, if you find work you enjoy, you'll never work a day in your life and blah, 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 things like that. But what does it mean if you actually don't have to work? Because having to work, even if it's a job you enjoy and love, is still a requirement. But what if you can combine not having to work as well as a job that you enjoy, then you really don't have to work a day in your life because it's completely a choice. And I think that's where the word work to me is so much associated with something that we have to do. So getting to a point where work optional is a reality, that means you're getting to a point where you can separate the word work from the requirement to do something. So what would it mean to you to be able to work less and work on your own choices to say, I want to do this, let me put it in my schedule versus I have to do this, how do I fit the rest of my schedule around this? It can be a pendulum that you swing on. Sometimes you may enjoy and want to work more. But sometimes you may want to work less and travel more. You can go back and forth. And sure, getting a job after a few years of less work may be tricky, but it's not impossible. And the good news is you don't have to go back to work if you're able to save yourself to a work optional point. If work is optional and you try to go back and maybe you can't land that job, sure, that'll be an adjustment because you were looking forward to working, but now you can't because you can't get a job or whatever. You're still at a point where you can do what you want so you can realign your priorities. Instead of feeling stuck like you have to go back to work, you're at a work optional point, so you can do whatever you want. And something else right here, if you're still listening at this point in the podcast, you definitely heard Eric share how he started over around 30 years old. So you may be listening now thinking, Yeah, Skyler, that's all great and fantastic. I love the idea of work optional, but I'm not starting in my teens or 20s. Even Eric started in his 30s, but even if you're in your 40s or 50s, this is still something that's completely possible. It might look different, but you also might have a good safety net of assets already built up that you can begin this foundation of work optional. And maybe it's not completely work optional. Maybe it's a point of where you can reduce your hours a little bit to give yourself a little bit more freedom. There's still so many options and opportunities for everybody. I'd love to chat with anyone about this. Head over to moneytalkwithskylarfleming.com/chat and let's talk about this. See what kind of opportunities and chances are still available for you, because I guarantee there's a lot of them. But you can start wherever you are and whenever you are, and you still have time on your side. The key is to just get started and take the next step. And speaking of next steps, let's take the next step into the next money talking point. The second money talking point is, how can you take the next step in your savings? Well, make sure it's a small one, because that can be what intimidates and scares so many people away from making progress in their personal finances. They think this big, gigantic, magical next step is going to fix everything for them, and they never bother to figure it out. And it's too big to honestly do all at once. So make sure it's a small step, something like increasing your 401k contribution 1%. You heard me, only 1%. You'll hear people say, make sure you get your savings rate up to 15, 20, 25%. Increase your 401k percent by 1. Start there. If it's at 0, set it at 1. And I highly doubt whether it's going from 0 to 1 or 5 to 6. I highly doubt you're going to notice that 1% change. Then in a few more months, make it 1% more. Your lifestyle will adjust, I promise. There's a great book about this called The Automatic Millionaire. I recommend this book as well. Go check it out. I highly, highly recommend it. And I bet it's at your local library, so you can get it for free. It's all about finding that next simple step and doing the next simple thing. And your lifestyle will adjust, like I mentioned. I promise it will. You're not even going to notice the 1% change, and you're going to be able to make it work. But like Eric said, it's a lot harder to go from 0 to 10 than it is to go from 4 to 5. So don't feel like you have to make a huge jump. Wade into it, tiptoe into it, and then before you know it, you'll find yourself saving a ton of money and not knowing how you were able to do it. I promise it will work. Not to mention, if you automate it, which is the next money talking point, it can help you a ton. So let's talk about automation. The third money talking point is, how can automation help you get started? Direct deposit is one of the most overlooked tools in our personal finance arsenal. It's something that so many people don't even consider as an actual tool for automation to help them mentally and behaviorally when it comes to their finances. It is so much more than just a tool to send your paycheck directly to your bank. You can create what I've begun calling a direct deposit IRA. If you don't have a 401k, you can set up your direct deposit to send a percentage of your income to an IRA in your name, and then set it up with automatic investments like an M1 Finance or an index mutual fund with Fidelity or Vanguard. Let automation and compound interest take its true role and spend time growing your money for you, and let it roll and roll and build up that snowball of money for you to have during retirement. And make sure you set up your dividends to automatically reinvest in whatever you're investing in. If you don't know how to do this, let me know. I'm happy to help you out. And I'm also sure any customer support agent can help you get this setting turned on. But here's a little secret. I didn't do this for a long time. So unfortunately, there was a period where compound interest was not really compounding. It was just depositing the dividends to my core cash account and not doing anything. How disappointing is that? So be sure when you start investing that your dividends are automatically going back into the security that they're paying out of. If you don't know how to do that, ask the customer support at your brokerage company or whoever you're investing with. But make sure to check the automation boxes so your money and computers behind it all can do all of the hard work. When it's automatic, you don't even have to think about it. That's just one simple step with direct deposit and dividends. You can also set up automation for your credit card payments and all sorts of other automatic transfers. Follow up real quick. If you were listening a couple weeks ago, you heard me mention that I was going to consider starting to use automatic payments and automatic statement balance payments for our credit cards. Here's the update. I did it. It works. It's so much easier. I don't have to sit there and compute all sorts of different credit card payment amounts to make the right amount and whatever. I just let that statement balance pay, make sure there's enough in the checking, and we're done. It is so much easier. I love it. Automatic payments for the win here. So make sure to use automatic payments on your credit cards. It helps you by saving some of the mental load that you have to do in order to pay bills. I love using automatic payments on my credit cards. It's going great. It's super simple. No more bill pay, all that sort of stuff. I love it. My mental load is drastically reduced with our credit card payments. But automation is the key to a good and happy financial system. So please remember that. And if you're curious how to get started with automation, head over to that moneytalkwithskylarfleming.com/chat page on my website. Schedule a free time with me and let's talk about how automation can help you level up your financial system. But that does it for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed those three money talking points as well as the interview with Eric. A reminder, I'm going on his show here shortly, so make sure to head over to the show notes, click on the link for his podcast, and check out my interview on there. Thank you, Eric, for coming on and being today's money buddy and teaching us all how to save for retirement and how to figure out how much we will need. We talked a lot about a lot of different things today, so remember, consider the next small step you can take to get started. Try to go from 0 to 1 instead of 0 to 10 with your savings. You're going to feel the punch a lot more if you go crazy with your savings, and then it's going to sour you to the idea of being able to save for things. So start small and continue making incremental steps to where you really want to be. Remember that time is the biggest factor, and it's a bigger factor than any amount of income or money you might have. So the earlier you start, the better. But if you haven't started, don't be too alarmed. Be somewhat alarmed, but figure out that next step you need to make and go and do it. Make it simple, easy, and knock it out of the park. You got this. If you need help identifying that step, sign up for Money Talk on my website, moneytalkwithskylarfleming.com/chat. But that does it for this episode. Thank you for listening to this episode. The best way to stay up to date and connected with all things Money Talk is to subscribe to the podcast and sign up for my email list. Head over to moneytalkwithskylarfleming.com and submit your name and email right there on the homepage. You can also use the contact page to send me any questions you might have. Be sure to check out the show notes for any links to resources you might have heard in today's episode. And remember, the best way to learn from today's episode is to go out and have a money talk about today's topic with a fellow money buddy. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Money Talk. I'm your host, Skylar Fleming. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Skylar Fleming. This show is provided for informational and entertainment purposes and may not be specific to your unique situation. Please be sure to do additional research before making any financial decisions.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.